morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Thank you for joining me on Saturday, August 6, 2016. Appreciate it's a kind of a little bit of an overcast day, but appreciate you joining us. Pleased to be joined by both the co-owner of Pete's Golf, Woody Lashin, and Golf Digest Senior Equipment Editor, Mike Stachura. How you guys doing today?
Doing great, Anthony.
Doing great.
All right. Mike, I wanted to start with you just to get right after it, and just wanted to talk about how big of the news, really, if you could put it in perspective for, I don't know, maybe just the, maybe not the serious golfer, but the semi-serious golfer, how serious and how big was the news about Nike leaving the hard goods industry this week?
Well, I mean, the announcement was surprising. I think, you know, first and foremost, I feel really bad and disappointed for the R&D folks on the hard goods side. They're exceptional people who are now out of a job. I think they've done things there at Nike that others were afraid to try. I don't know that they were ever as successful as in the hard goods end as they were projected to be. I think that was, you know, it was always the case that, that people in the golf industry were afraid that Nike was going to become this 800-pound gorilla that there was no way for them to compete with. And, you know, I think it shows that golf is a really difficult industry. And, you know, in terms of the impact on the marketplace, you know, let's remember, Nike's still committed to their strengths, which are apparel and footwear, where they are, you know, easily in the top three of those two areas. So that's a serious commitment, and that's kind of their current position of significance isn't going to go away. In the hard goods end of things, yes, they spent a lot of promotional money at times, but they never were a presence in the industry. I mean, I did a story the other day on GolfDigest.com where we, you know, essentially have some folks saying this is not like a TaylorMade exiting the hard goods business, and that's really overstating it. I mean, Nike's share in clubs was, you know, for most of their existence, less than 5%, and sometimes less than 3%. You know, they had some presence in golf balls, but most of the time that presence was in under $20 golf balls. So I'm not sure that it's, you know, it's a bad sort of PR look, but if you look behind the initial reaction, you know, it's not a huge blow. Yes, golf would be better off if Nike was fully committed. I think we'll see the biggest blow, and I saw it Tuesday and Wednesday at Travelers. You know, Nike's a big presence on tour, and that's it'll be interesting to see how that money either stays or is distributed differently or goes away, and how players and agents start to scramble.
I just want to say something as far as the equipment goes from my standpoint.
Yeah, that's how I was going to turn right to you and say, since you're the guy, you're part of where the rubber hits the road, was this something that you saw coming? Was this something that, you know, how will this affect you, really, overall?
I mean, I'm not surprised at all. We have not been carrying Nike hard goods. I can tell you that when they had some good products that performed well, it was a very hard sell.
Mm-hmm.
The golfer that came in, if it worked really good and maybe better than someone else's product, the fact that it said Nike on the bottom, you know, it turned golfers off. I mean, you know, obviously the diehard golfer, I suspect that they probably sold a lot of, you know, starter sets and the like at, you know, at Dick's, but obviously, that business is somewhat going away. It's, you know, it's there. You know, Dick's is doing less golf, so and you don't think you could make any money there. But in the premium stuff, we haven't sold it in a long time, and I'm not surprised. I actually think it's a great move for them because I think that they're spending a lot of money trying to develop products and get traction, and they can't. And I can remember when Nike first came in here trying to sell hard goods, I remember Nike management saying, listen, you know, we've never been in the golf business, golf business before, but let me tell you what, we weren't in the soccer business either, and within 5 years, we were number one in the soccer business. We're going to do the same thing in the golf business. And I'm thinking to myself, really, that would be impressive, and it's what, about 20 years now they've been in the hard clubs business, Mike? I'm not sure exactly how many years it is.
Yeah, well, you know, they've made balls in 98, and that was kind of where they dip their toe in, and it's been a solid 15 years of products. So it's not like they only tried for 5 years.
Yeah, so they gave it a good run, and you know, I think they make incredible shoes, and they make great apparel, and you know, that's the one thing I keep telling people is that yes, they're getting out of the hard goods business, but they're not getting out of the golf business. You're going to see them where I think that they should be, selling their shoes and, selling their apparel. I don't think they're going to get rid of, Mike would probably know much better than me, if they're going to get rid of their tour staff. I mean, they'll obviously change their deals. They don't have equipment deals, but
I was going to say the tour situation is very interesting because obviously they've come out and said, we want to be number one in footwear and apparel. Well, you can't be that without significant tour presence. But, you know, globally, I've heard that they spend, you know, maybe $100 million on tour.
Wow.
So are they still going to do that? Well, let's remember, you know, that $100 million includes probably 40 to Tiger and Rory.
Yeah, right. Mike, when you look back now at their, let's say, Nike's, maybe it's more than just a college try, how would you evaluate what they did, what they could have done better, where did they fail, that kind of thing? How would you evaluate or, how would you assess their so-called, let's say, college try into the hard good business?
You know, I think, Woody's right that even when they had interesting and significant product, there was still this barrier to entry. And I think, you know, it's not my area of expertise, but I really think there was something to the aesthetic, the Nike-ness of their look and product or general presentation. I mean, you look at just some of the colors that they chose were really like non-golf colors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they wanted to sort of put this stamp on their product that we're Nike and we're changing everything. And golf isn't exactly that. Like even, you know, if you go back 35 years with Callaway, you know, Callaway was changing everything, but they found a way to change it within the authenticity of golf. And Callaway is a new company, and they made a driver that was, you know, a third bigger than anybody else's driver, but it was steel colored. And
right,
you know,
right,
and they used the Old English script in their name. It was almost like, and Nike sort of tried this a couple of times where they didn't super emphasize the swoosh, but, you know, they would have red, I mean, they had red products that were weirdly red that were great that nobody wanted to try because they were red. Or
even
the most recent driver, which I think was better than their previous drivers, you know, was this electric blue with the giant neon swoosh on the club, and it was just sort of unnecessarily in your face.
Right.
You know, Mike, I think a problem for me, from my looking at it, they had success in changing the golf industry acceptance of footwear. So if you think about before they came in, you really didn't see many people wearing sneaker type golf shoes. It was all saddle stuff and You know, they've done a great job with innovating of, you know, more sneaker-like looking footwear. And I think they said, oh, we can do the same kind of thing with our golf clubs. But the golfer who wears those shoes is not playing with a red driver.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
I think. Yeah, no, exactly. There are areas where it's okay to sort of step outside the... but even when they stepped outside in shoes and footwear, for the most part, they didn't go super crazy. You know, quite honestly, I saw other shoes and apparel that were more bizarre than what Nike was doing at times.
Sure.
And they had a great model in Tiger Woods to display their clothes, and he never wore anything that was bizarre. I mean, if you look at the first Tiger Woods shoes, you know, it looked like you could wear those to church. So
right.
Right.
So, you know, it wasn't like they went too far in that area. They just, you know, I think you missed some of the opportunity to get people interested in your hard goods before they even tried it.
Right.
So, I think there were things that were exceptional there. You know, I think people may have made fun of the slingshot iron, but it worked. And people may not have liked the red color of the CPR hybrids, but they worked. And I think the golf ball technology with the resin was, again, a idea that nobody else was trying, made sense, really got the discussion going about that sort of spin separation curve between short irons and the driver, and elevated some discussion about golf ball technology, spurred others on. I mean, let's face it, tour accuracy, Tiger Woods puts it in play, and 6 months later, or less, actually 3 months later, Pro V1 comes along. So, you know, you can't say that their ideas weren't valid and in essence, in some cases, copied by others. Now you can go back and forth on who actually had the first successful multi-layer urethane cover non-wound golf ball. But
right.
Their ideas were valid. I think they were... In spots, they were too Nike.
Gotcha.
Mike, I'm curious, who do you think will benefit most from them exiting the market?
You know, I don't know.
Nobody benefit.
No, I mean, it's a sort of small share of the business. I think there's opportunities for the smaller companies as opposed to the bigger companies. I think the Callaways, TaylorMades, and Titleists, to extent, are really set with their tour, and they don't necessarily want to overextend themselves. I think, you know, there are opportunities for small companies like Mizuno, who are okay with the player not having a Mizuno logo on the hat, and they'll just be able to supply these guys with clubs and support them that way on tour without having to spend as much on the marketing side. So, you know, the big question is what happens to a Rory and to some lesser degree, the Brooks Koepka, Tony Finau, because those are the three sort of biggest guys. I mean, I think we're sort of the opinion that Tiger's irrelevant until he tells us he's not.
Right. You know what, gentlemen, let's go to a commercial break, and then we'll come back and we'll pick this up. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
The Long Island Golf Association is a nonprofit organization of 81 private and public clubs. The LIGA conducts 15 championships annually and works closely with the Long Island Caddy Scholarship Fund. The scholarships are granted to young men and women who are employed at member clubs. For more information on how you can participate in a championship, or if you'd like to donate your time as a volunteer, please call the LIGA at 516-746-1015. That's 516-746-1015, or visit us at www.longislandgolf.org. Is your inspection due? Are you tired of listening to that noise your car is making? If you're looking for a reliable shop to service your car, try A1 Action Auto for all your car service needs. A1 Auto is a New York State certified shop, and owner Ed Terabile has over 25 years of experience. A1 Action Auto is conveniently located off Sunrise Highway in West Islip, so pick up the phone and call A1 Action Auto at 631-321-4242. That's 631-321-4242.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Talking with co-owner of Pete's Golf, Woody Lashin, and senior equipment editor at Golf Digest, Mike Stachura. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me this morning. Mike, I wanted to touch base about the whole idea of, and if this is a case study, or maybe what impact, let's say, these events are going to have on signing players in terms of, here Nike had two of the biggest names in golf, if you will, especially with, you know, first signing Tiger Woods, and then in a couple of years later, or however long later, you tell the company or the world of golf you're leaving the hard goods business. What impact is this going to have on player signings in terms of, you know, do players really sell clubs?
Well, I've always been of the opinion that the only golfer was able to sell golf clubs was Ben Hogan, so we've been struggling to find his replacement. But I think what's really going to happen is, you know, the idea of making players head to toe one company or one brand may be sliding away, and you're going to have to see even the best players take more of an approach, like, say, Zach Johnson, okay, which, you know, you can say Zach Johnson looks like a walking billboard, but the fact is he's made a lot of deals that have, you know, worked out for him, and it's maybe the way of the future. So instead of a someone Nike head-to-toe, or someone TaylorMade Adidas head-to-toe, or somebody Titleist FootJoy head-to-toe, we may be in an era where the hat is, say, more like Phil Mickelson, right, where he's got a sponsor on the hat, a sponsor on the breast of his shirt, Callaway on the side, other Callaway deals, you know, in the bag. So, you know, I don't want to say that we're trending toward NASCAR, but I think, you know, if Nike's money is not going to be there in some form, I don't see another company coming in and saying, well, we're going to fill that void all by ourselves. I mean, I had a conversation with Bob Parsons a couple of days ago, and he's more of the opinion, like, well, if Nike wants to take the apparel and footwear end of things, I'm happy to support their the player on the equipment side. Now, then it becomes a negotiation of, you know, who gets the front of the hat, and that'll be a change, obviously, from where we've been. I had a conversation yesterday with Tim Clark of Wilson, and, you know, Wilson has sort of had past arrangements with Nike on the golf ball front, and done some things with them. So, you know, I think they're seeing this as an opportunity in terms of, you know, an opportunity in terms of partnerships and multiple partnerships, and that's where tour endorsements are going to go in the future.
Do you think, well, speaking of Bob Parsons, where, you know, how does this affect him in terms of, do you think, you know, his role in the landscape here, what do you think is the future for PXG?
You know, Bob's shooting from the hip or the lip, depending on how you look at it. I mean, he said, well, you know, I'm not interested in Tiger Woods, but, you know, his best is, you know, what he was is past, but I'd certainly be interested in Rory, and I'd certainly be interested in Brooks Koepka, and I'd certainly be interested in Tony Finau, and I'd be interested in Michelle Wee. You know, his approach has been no hat, no deal, so I'll have to see how that works. But, you know, he said, hey, I've gotten more than 30 calls already from players and agents, and You know, I think the problem with Parsons PXG is how much tour presence do they need to be perceived as a legitimate golf brand, given what I think is a monumentally small-sized actual consumer audience for those clubs.
Yeah, I was going to turn that to you, Woody. I mean, how much is you know, we're just saying that if Nike couldn't sell with Tiger and Rory, how will that translate to PXG in terms of how, you know, where you are, where you sit, where the rubber hits the road?
Well, I mean, I think PXG is such a different animal. You know, I mean, PXG golf clubs aren't selling because Zach Johnson's using them or, you know, anyone else to them. They're selling because they perform, and they're selling to a limited audience who can afford them. Obviously, here we have a lot more people that can afford them and say, hey, look, they're coming in looking for the best performance, and, you know, that club is going to maybe win more often than not. It performs really good. How is that going to get affected nationally? I mean, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, when I go to my wife's home state of New Mexico, I don't think there's anybody going to be playing PXG there. You know, so it's all a question of the demographic where you're at. And I don't really think it will affect him other than, listen, if he can get, you know, Rory to play his clubs, that certainly gives him a lot more visibility, but I don't think it affects them directly. I mean, they're in a different space.
Right.
They're in a different space, and you know, you could even make the argument that why does he need Rory to play his clubs? He's already gotten such a huge portion of the golf conversation, and it doesn't matter how much Golf Digest or Woody at the direct-to-consumer conversation level talks about PXG, 95% of the golfing population could not even begin to imagine paying for those clubs.
Right.
So unless PXG changes its business model and starts selling irons for $800, which is totally anathema to what Bob Parsons wants to do right now.
Right.
I don't see how that's, you know, it's like PXG would have to, if PXG is Lexus right now, it would be like PXG would have to say, well, we're going to start a separate division that's Toyota and call it something else. And then you got a whole other set of problems that I don't think Bob Parsons wants. You know, he does not want to have to deal with the PGA Tour Superstore or Golfsmith or Golf Galaxy or even Dick's in setting up his business model. You know, it doesn't compute. So,
you know, Mike, that's actually a great segue there. I read just a couple of days ago, Bloomberg reported that Golfsmith is for sale and they're actually considering filing Chapter 11. I'm curious what you could tell us what you've heard about that.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that on the surface, that looks like, oh, Golfsmith is in trouble. And, you know, from what I hear from my sources, this is a sort of bad business decision. It's not that golf is bad business. In other words, Golfsmith has some real estate issues right now in terms of store locations that are not in the best setting. They've got sort of need to make some loan payments and that sort of thing, so they need some influx of cash. And let's not forget that it's not like Golfsmith is owned by Golfsmith. Golfsmith is owned essentially by a municipal employees pension fund in Canada. Okay, that pension fund obviously wants to be fully funded. They are close to being fully funded, but they are not. And so I'm sure they looked at golf and said, well, let's sell our Golfsmith International division that we own and let's pick up some quick cash. And that wasn't happening as quickly as they wanted it to. And maybe Chapter 11 gets makes them more attractive to sell. You know, Golfsmith's still opening stores, last I checked. So, you know, I think there's also obviously a change in the retail experience. You know, places like Pete's Golf are successful because they're offering something that, that is of extreme value and seen as more important than sort of treating golf retail like going to the grocery store for eggs and milk.
Right.
Right?
It's, yeah, it's no, much, exactly.
Much more considered purchase these days, so you want to trust an expert rather than some guy who may not be, you know, certainly might not have the experience that, that Woody and Pete and the team have there. So, so I think, and then there's also a lot of companies, equipment companies, that are exploring selling directly to consumers.
Right.
So I think there's a question. And then on top of all that, you see PGA Tour Superstore expanding. You know, they just opened their 26th store, which was 41,000 square feet in Minnesota. So I think you got to look at it in perspective. And sometimes, you know, just like with the Nike thing, Nike made a business decision that they couldn't compete in the hard goods. Golfsmith is in a business situation where we need to get our financial house sorted out from a, you know, financial end of things. And it may be that golf is a different business now. Golf is not going to grow double digit on an annual basis, and you got to adjust and compete. And certainly, say, companies like Titleist and Ping are figuring that out, and maybe PGA Tour Superstore is figuring that out, that we don't need 150 stores. We just need a small number of big stores in the right places.
You know, golf is such a, the golf industry is such a multi-layered, you know, industry. I think there's always going to be that, that sort of, not fight, I guess you could say, you know, fight between, let's say, a PGA Superstore for the person who's always looking for the deal, and Pete's Golf for the which is for the serious golfer. And there's always going to be this sort of push and pull between the two in terms of the marketplace. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we've seen the, you know, 25, 30 years ago when people were buying equipment, they were going to see their pro, and that's completely disappeared. And now I think we've kind of, it's swinging back in the direction of, well, I don't want to go see my pro for equipment, and I don't want to go necessarily to the large retail place. I want to go to a guy that I trust. And yeah, is there an appeal to a 41,000 square foot superstore? Yeah, if I'm in Myrtle Beach or Scottsdale, and I have a huge consumer base that's already playing golf all the time, that's possible. But, you know, do I need a Golfsmith in Norwalk, Connecticut? I don't know that I do.
Right.
So it's a different model. And I think there are plenty of segments within the golf business that are successful.
Got about 1 minute. You wanted to say something, but we've got about 1 minute left.
I was going to say, from my standpoint, I mean, I have plenty of my customers that go shop at Golfsmith and shop at PGA Superstore to buy their shoes, to buy their golf bags, to buy their shirts, stuff that I don't sell. I mean, that, it can only come to me to get clubs.
Right.
I don't do the other stuff. And, you know, I think that they're doing, you know, a good job of that stuff. They need to, you know, in my opinion, you know, they know what they're good at and what they're not good at. And I personally don't think that Golfsmith's going anywhere. I don't know the ins and outs like Mike does, but I don't think they're going anyplace. I think they just need, you know,
a little
maybe
restructuring,
clean some things up and get themselves back on track. But,
well, gentlemen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time enough. It's been very informative, very insightful. Mike, thank you for getting up early and tuning in with us. Woody, thank you for joining me as always. Appreciate you guys.
Thanks. It was great.
Thanks for having us, Vinny.
Thank you. Have a good day, guys. All right, that was Mike Stratora from Golf Digest and Woody Lashin, Pete's Golf Shop, filling us in on all the details of what it means for Golfsmith and Nike cleaving the hard goods. Have a great weekend, everybody.